live from the Poly Market Studio in L.A. It's the Young Turks.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Watching The Young Turks. I'm your host, Anna Kasparian, and we have a fantastic and gigantic show ahead for you all today. The one thing that I'll tease right off the bat is our bonus episode for our members, because as always on Wednesdays, John Iadarola will be joining me both for the bonus episode and the second hour. And we have a pretty big surprise that you don't want to miss. So if you're a member, definitely tune in. And if you're a member, you don't have to watch live. You can just watch whenever you want because you have access to our archives. If you're not a member, you can become one by clicking on the join button or going to tyt.com/join to become a member. With that said, we have so much news, so I want to get right to it. Let's start with our first story. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer has announced that he will be retiring. Now, we all learned about this in a way that's unusual from what typically happens when a Supreme Court justice decides they want to retire. There wasn't really a big formal announcement. And since that was so unusual, there was a lot of speculation and analysis as to why the decision was made in this way. And we'll get to that in just a minute. But let me begin by saying that Stephen Breyer retiring makes a lot of sense. He's 83 years old. It seemed as though he was very offended at progressives pressuring him to resign last year, but he has made the decision to resign is not the right word, retire. I would argue for obvious reasons, but maybe some haven't caught on yet. So let's discuss that. Now, again, the announcement was not a formal one. And so there are some theories that the reason why he made that decision is to avoid looking too political. Now, keep in mind that Justice Breyer is deemed one of the more liberal justices. He's certainly liberal when it comes to social issues, when it comes to conservative versus liberal issues. But when it comes to corporate issues, he tends to agree with the more corporatist judges. And we'll get to those details in a moment. But before we do so, I thought that this video from CBS, the analysis that you're about to hear, was somewhat enlightening. So let's watch that and then I'll break it down.
By kind of informally letting people know in Washington, whether in the White House or on Capitol Hill, this can kind of get the ball rolling so that President Biden can be ready to announce his possible replacement. Those hearings can get started earlier in the summer. A justice will be confirmed by the time the next court session starts in October, and of course, well in advance of the midterm. So it is a way of kind of depoliticizing the process. It's a way that if that's possible with the Supreme Court. And it's a way that Justice Breyer could kind of get in front of this before that drumbeat of pressure starts up again from progressives that he stepped down. He was very almost insulted last year by, and I was told by multiple people at the court, that there was this pressure on him to step down because of everything he's done for the court.
Now look, the unwillingness of liberal Supreme Court justices to retire in time has led to a pretty terrible situation where the Supreme Court is overwhelmingly conservative. And so oftentimes when we discuss the ramifications of that, we discuss it in the context of these social issues, which to be sure, there's still important issues. I mean, when we're talking about reproductive rights, that is nothing to joke around about. That is still very serious. But when it comes to decisions in regard to workers versus corporations, even with a more evenly divided Supreme Court, even in a context where you had more liberal Supreme Court justices rather than conservative Supreme Court justices, you would still see these pro-corporate decisions handed down. And I'll give you examples of that in a bit. But this is big news. It's big news not only because this could have an impact on the Biden administration's ability to replace a liberal justice with another liberal justice. It also communicates something, it implies something. And what it implies, especially considering that he did not want to step down or retire last year, is that he can read the tea leaves much like the rest of the country. The Biden administration is in a lot of trouble. And for, you know, Breyer to remain on the Supreme Court, knowing that it is likely that Republicans are going to take control of the Senate, that would be pretty irresponsible. If Biden has any shot at ensuring that he would have any influence on the Supreme Court, Breyer would need to retire. And I think that's the decision that he has decided to make. I think that the notion that this is not political, that this is an effort to make it depoliticized, you know, by not announcing it formally, is ridiculous. Of course it's political. Everything is political. All these decisions get made with politics in mind. We know this. So I think this was the right move. I would much rather have Biden, as much as I disagree and really hate how he's handled the presidency so far, I'd rather have him nominate a Supreme Court justice in Breyer's place than a Republican sometime in the future. And if he is to do that, it would need to happen soon. Because again, Republicans are likely to take control of the Senate, and it would be unlikely that a Republican controlled Senate would confirm Biden's nomination, you know. It's just fact of the matter. We know what happened to Merrick Garland. We don't have to rehash all of that. Okay, so with that said, let's also talk about what this means for the future of the Supreme Court. I am not willing to predict that the Democratic Party will not somehow bungle this. I think that that's still a possibility. There's still a possibility that the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, certainly in the Senate, could stand in the way of this. Who's to say that Joe Manchin doesn't stand in the way of the confirmation for, you know, Breyer's replacement? I mean, obviously he could be bought easily, same with Sinema. Obviously, there's no amount of public rage that persuades them to do otherwise. And we also know that the Biden administration is unwilling to ever apply any pressure to ensure passage of the administration's agenda. So if Manchin is legally bribed through our system of legalized bribery to vote against confirming Biden's pick, I don't see Biden really doing anything about it. I see him like raising his hands in the air, throwing his hands in the air and just saying like, what could I do? There's a, you know, Manchin's a good guy. Sinema's smart as the devil and they're great. And I'm gonna say all sorts of complimentary things about them, even though they've stood in the way of everything I've wanted to accomplish. So I wanna just put that out there. I'm not certain that's what the outcome will be. I'm just saying there's still a possibility that Democrats will bungle this. With that said though, there's already talk about possible Supreme Court picks by Joe Biden. This next video will give you a few details into that. And then we'll talk about how important it is to replace Breyer with someone who's not simply another Breyer, but someone who's actually progressive. Let's watch.
Justice Breyer was the most senior liberal justice after Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died just over a year ago, but he was no means the furthest left on the court. So I do think that President Biden has the opportunity to put onto the court a nominee who is both more progressive than Justice Breyer, and importantly, quite a bit younger than Justice Breyer. President Biden has suggested very strongly that he would like to nominate a woman of color, ideally an African-American woman, to the Supreme Court, which would be a first if he does put an African-American woman on the court. And there are some very, very distinguished shortlisters whose names we have heard in circulation. One, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, a judge on the D.C. Circuit. She's actually a former Breyer clerk herself and an extremely distinguished jurist after a very distinguished career in practice. The D.C. Circuit is kind of like the junior Supreme Court. It's the second most powerful court in the country, so that's a natural stepping stone to the Supreme Court. We've also heard the name Leandra Kruger, also an African-American woman, a justice on the California Supreme Court, also an incredibly distinguished career in the federal government. She argued before the Supreme Court many times in the Solicitor General's office and has now been on the California Supreme Court for about 7 years. So I think those two are at the top of the list.
Now, I'm sure all of the women you saw on the screen are perfectly lovely. This is not a commentary about, you know, what I think about them specifically, but it is a commentary about the way that discussion was handled on CBS, because what did the commentary and analysis really center on? The identity, the physical identity, the race identity, the gender identity of the people who might be considered, which is fine. There's no problem. In fact, it's great to have diversity on the Supreme Court, but there's absolutely no analysis about the substance of the women mentioned, right? Meaning, are these individuals who have a more progressive take, certainly on issues where you have to make decisions in regard to labor versus corporations? Because what we do need on the Supreme Court, what we desperately need on the Supreme Court, is more representation for workers. Even in the context of a more liberal Supreme Court, even in the context of a Supreme Court that includes Breyer, we have seen one pro-corporate ruling after the next. And I want to give you the details about that, which was written in a piece by the Daily Poster, David Sirota reporting. Data from the Constitutional Accountability Center tell the story of a seismic transformation in American jurisprudence. Whereas Chief Justice Warren Burger's court sided with chamber, meaning the US Chamber of Commerce, with chamber amicus briefs just 43% of the time, the Roberts Court has sided with the chamber 70% of the time, including 83% of the time in the most recent session. Breyer himself has voted with the chamber position a majority of the time. So I give you that information because it's not simply good enough, if you ask me, to replace Breyer with someone who is socially liberal. We need representation for workers on the Supreme Court. And yes, I totally understand that even if a progressive is the one who ends up replacing Breyer, we still have a conservative majority in the Supreme Court. But if we have an opportunity to make sure that there's progressive representation, worker representation on the Supreme Court, we need to fight for that. In practice, that has meant Breyer recently voting to restrict regulations' power to punish Wall Street criminals, to empower fossil fuel companies to brush off environmental concerns, and to oppose a state mining ban. It means Breyer voting to shield companies from liability when they face allegations of human rights abuses abroad. It means Breyer voting to limit consumer debt protections. And as the progressive legal publication Balls and Strikes notes, Breyer's 27-year career of rulings have protected big business privilege from antitrust lawsuits. We need to stop allowing the media to divert our attention to the aesthetics of change, when in reality, what ends up happening is the continuation of the status quo. And so again, I have no problem whatsoever with racially diverse Supreme Court. I think that would be wonderful. But we also need to ensure that aside from the racial diversity, the gender diversity, we ensure that we have representation that is not represented right now in the Supreme Court. And that's representation that actually uplifts workers and protects workers as opposed to corporate interests. All right, well, I'm sure we'll have a lot more news on that as it develops, but for now, why don't we move on? Now, with the Biden administration suffering from alarmingly low approval ratings, they have decided we need to figure out who to blame for our failures. And so corporate Democrats, along with corporate media, have decided to pick their fall guy, the person who takes the blame. And it just so happens to be Ron Klain, Biden's chief of staff. Why? Well, they purport that Ron Klain has just given too much to progressives. And it is for that reason that the Biden administration has failed. I'm not kidding. This is a literal article that is published in the Washington Post. The headline is, Ron Klain had the perfect resume. His first year showed the limits of that experience. And try to contain yourselves as I go through excerpts from this piece, because it gives you a sense of what's to come. Something that we've predicted here at TYT, that as the corporate Democrats continue to fail as a result of their lack of strategy, as a result of the fact that they're completely beholden to corporate interests, as a result of their fecklessness, they will refuse to take responsibility, look for scapegoats, and blame progressives. And that process has already begun. They write in the Washington Post, Klain has drawn criticism that he is aligned too closely with Democrats' left wing. Because you know, guys, look at what ended up happening during the Biden administration so far. Progressives got so many parts of their agenda passed, right? Except they didn't. They didn't. The only thing that the Biden administration has done thus far is continue Trump era immigration policies. In fact, Biden's DOJ is fighting to maintain those awful, cruel immigration policies as we speak. They're going to federal courts and they're doing everything they can to defend those policies. What else did the Biden administration do so far? They passed some COVID stimulus, but to be quite honest with you, with the exception of the child tax credit, I think it's comparable to what we saw during the Trump administration and the stimulus bills that passed under his watch. And then you have that wonderful corporate handout bill that's usually referred to as the bipartisan infrastructure bill. You know, that legislation that will privatize public infrastructure. Yes, it includes some provisions that are positive, but the reason why you had bipartisan support for that bill is because corporate, you know, donors were salivating over it. They love the idea of these public-private partnerships. They love the idea of taxpayer money being funneled to them in the form of government contracts to deal with the nation's infrastructure. So to argue that the failures that we're seeing is a result of, you know, playing patty cakes with progressives is absolutely ridiculous. But let me continue. They write, among the strongest criticisms of Klain come from Democrats who say he has forged an alliance with the party's left that has undercut Biden's effectiveness and hurt his political image. Okay, so it's not the corporate Democrats in the Senate. According to the Washington Post and according to corporate Democrats, it's not Manchin and Sinema. Individuals who have literal financial interests in blocking Biden's agenda. It's not them who stood in the way. It's the progressives. It's the progressives. How stupid is that? And by the way, it's not stupid. They know what they're doing. They're looking for the fall guy and they've decided that it's Ron Klain. The unwillingness to take responsibility is motivated by the fact that they love that corporate money. That's it. They got to provide cover for that. And this is their way of doing it. Here's more. Many complaints center on negotiations with Capitol Hill over Biden's agenda this past fall, with many Democrats charging that Klain acceded too often to the demands of the Congressional Progressive Caucus at a critical juncture. The talks left House Democratic leaders, including Pelosi, feeling upset with Klain. Oh, Pelosi, she was very upset. Now, what was she upset about? She was upset that Klain allegedly empowered progressives in their unwillingness to vote for the infrastructure bill until there was clear passage for the social spending bill, the Build Back Better agenda that has all those provisions that would actually materially improve all of our lives. Universal pre-K, child tax credits, all of that stuff. You know, the spending bill that Pelosi pretended to care so much about, she cares about her legacy, ladies and gentlemen. You know, it's for the children, she cares about the children. Well, she was upset that Ron Klain didn't tell progressives to bow their heads and vote for the infrastructure bill to ensure that the corporate handouts were in place. That's what she was upset about. No, that sounds like a Nancy Pelosi problem. That sounds like a corporate Democrat problem. That sounds like a corruption problem, not a Ron Klain problem, not a progressive problem, but I'll continue. So Some Democrats complained about Klain's frequent conversations with Congressional Progressive Caucus Chairwoman Pramila Jayapal, saying they felt that allowed her to influence the White House strategy in a way that has been harmful to the party. Pramila Jayapal tucked tail and played ball way too soon. The idea that the Progressive Caucus and Ron Klain engaging in negotiations with the Progressive Caucus is the real problem is insane. Because remember, there was a period of time when there were enough progressives in the Progressive Caucus who raised their hands and said, we're gonna vote no on the infrastructure bill until we see a path forward for the social spending bill. What was Ron Klain supposed to do in that context? Ignore them, give them the middle finger, hold a vote on the infrastructure bill and watch it fail? Like, how dumb is this? And by the way, good luck, corporate Democrats, trying to win your reelection races in the midterms by promoting a corporate handout bill. I'm sure it's gonna work out real well for you. Looking forward to that. Now, Klain rejected the critique from some centrists that the White House agenda has been too ambitious. Can you imagine thinking that the White House agenda is too ambitious? Turning off swing voters. I think the challenge here is not that we've tried to do too much, it's that we still have work left to do, Klain said. And he's right about that. They have a lot of work to do, but oops, Biden's already a lame duck president. But that's not Biden's fault. It's Ron Klain's fault, it's, I don't know, progressives' fault, it's the guy in the corner's fault. I don't know, any scapegoat will do as long as we provide cover for corporate Democrats who love their legalized bribes. There's more. Now, apparently Klain really hurt the feelings of poor, poor Joe Manchin. You know, Joe Manchin loves to pump his chest and pretend like he's this big tough guy. But he also alleges that his feelings got hurt from a strongly worded letter from Ron Klain, just like a little bitch. Klain had a hand in drafting an unusually bitter statement, excoriating Manchin after the senator came out against Biden's Build Back Better social spending and climate bill, according to the White House official, according to a White House official. Manchin has complained publicly about the White House staff, and people close to him say those frustrations largely center on Klain. Manchin has told allies that he believes Klain has pushed Biden to embrace a more liberal policy agenda, adding that Klain must repair the relationship with him if the chief of staff is to be involved in future negotiations. So let's be clear about something. Manchin didn't really get his feelings hurt. Manchin was looking for any excuse to say, nope, can't do it. I just can't vote for the social spending bill. Imagine being a United States senator who votes no, who says that he is willing to block a popular social spending bill because his bitch ass feelings were hurt. Now that's not the reality, but he's willing to, Manchin is willing to humiliate himself like that just to appease his corporate donors. But according to the Washington Post and according to the Democratic Party, Manchin's not the bad guy. The chief of staff for Biden's the bad guy. How insane is that? And the reason why Klain is a bad guy is because he allegedly gave progressives too much. And by the way, going back to Pramila Jayapal for just one second. Is that really a leader? As I mentioned earlier, she tugged tail and went along with what the corporate Democrats wanted because she believed that Biden would deliver the social spending bill. He didn't even fight for it. We gotta be smarter than that. Pramila Jayapal, not fit to be the head of the Progressive Caucus. Not strategic, certainly not smart when it came to this particular issue. And now, everything that we predicted would happen is happening. The Biden administration and corporate Democrats are blaming all of their failures on us, on progressives. It's all our fault. We had the audacity to fight for incredibly popular policies that the vast majority of Americans are in favor of, including Republican voters. We had the audacity to want to ensure that the nation's children don't starve. We had the audacity to, you know, wanted to make sure there was a more equal distribution of wealth in this country. We wanted to make sure that corporations and the wealthy paid their fair share in taxes. How dare we? It's our fault. It's our fault. We know the truth, though. It's not really our fault. We know that Congress, including members of the Democratic Party, have no interest in really representing us. They are completely captured by corporate interests. And unless we have a smart, well-organized, militant outside strategy to apply pressure to members of Congress and the executive branch, we're never gonna get what we want. We're gonna see the same playbook over and over and over again. We're not geniuses. We didn't predict this because we're super smart and we can read tea leaves that no one else can read. I've been here for 15 years. It's the same playbook over and over again. Get organized. Electoral politics is one small part of getting what we need to get done. That's it. When we come back, Vivek Chhibber, professor at NYU, will be joining me to talk about why capitalism continues to thrive even as it fails so many people in the United States. We'll come right back. Welcome back to the show. I'm Anna Kasparian. Let's get to our next story. So, as we all know, we've seen the failures of capitalism with growing inequality. We see deteriorating conditions for workers, yet the system seems to thrive. Why is that? And why is it that we have not seen the type of labor militancy that this country experienced in the lead up to the New Deal? Now, there is some good news. There is this willingness to focus on capitalism that hasn't really been the case for generations in this country. That's the good news. The question is, though, how do we organize? How do we use that to our advantage to reform the system, to change this system? And here to talk to me about that is Vivek Chhibber, who is a professor of sociology at New York University and has published widely on social theory and politics. He's also the editor of the journal Catalyst, which he launched in 2017, and the author of his latest book, The Class Matrix: Social Theory After the Cultural Turn. Vivek, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Anna. I hope you can hear me okay.
Yes, you sound great. So
all right.
I'm excited to talk to you about this, especially because it's so fitting given what you typically like to lecture and talk about, which is this focus on identity, this focus on culture, which has really taken over our political discussions. It's really taken over academia for many, many years. And it's been a shift away from class consciousness. And just today, Justice Stephen Breyer, told White House officials that he plans on retiring soon. It's likely to happen in June. And immediately there have been some reports, some speculation in regard to who Biden is gonna replace him with. And the focus has been squarely on identity, which is fine, but there's really no discussion about the substance of the individuals that we're discussing. It's just, he wants to replace Breyer with an African-American woman. Okay, great, but we have a very pro-corporate Supreme Court. What about the representation for workers? And that's not part of the discussion at all. So can you discuss why that is? This is something that's been ongoing in the country.
The answer is simple, Anna. It's because there is no social group, social agency, and social force pushing our politics in a more substantive direction. It's kind of interesting that the discussion goes immediately to getting a black woman or a Latino when Biden made a choice on those grounds for his vice president. And look how that worked out for him. The most unpopular vice president in modern history, serving the most unpopular president in modern history. So you would imagine that they might learn their lessons from this, but there's no inclination to do so. And the reason for that is, as long as they keep playing this game of thickening the multicultural identity of the political elite, of the corporate elite, they can pass it off, they can palm it off as somehow being progressive. And the reason is that in the circles that actually dominate politics today and political discussions today, those circles being the class of journalists, politicos, academics, who are involved in it, they all come from a class background where these identity concerns is what really motivates them. And so the filter that sort of stands in the way of the public and the elites, that filter being the media, being the intellectuals, being the journalists, that filter is perfectly happy to play this game because it allows the entire complex, the political elite, the corporate community, and the intellectuals, never to take up the kinds of issues and the kinds of policies that would benefit the vast majority, because those policies go against the interests of the most powerful sections of society.
And I mean, you certainly see this with both political parties, just this willingness to endlessly, you know, fall into culture war issues. More recently, I would argue, manufactured culture war issues. And it's just dominating the news cycle, it's dominating political debate. And you know, it can be traced back to, you know, you write, the fall of the Soviet Union and how there was this shift away from class consciousness and just this hyper focus on cultural issues in lieu of class consciousness. Can you talk about that context a little?
Yeah, the fall of the Soviet Union certainly played a role in this, but the fundamental issue was the decline of the labor movement. You know, if you look back at the history of liberalism, Anna, liberal politics it starts out around 1830, 1840, you could say, modern liberalism, perhaps a little bit earlier. From the start, liberalism was attached to the ambitions and the interests of small property classes, the salaried shopkeepers, professionals, and it was always aimed at getting a place for themselves within the ruling order, more say, more influence, etc., and easily veered into culture wars, cultural issues, and narrow politics. What made liberalism, for a brief period, attuned and sensitive to the concerns of working people was that those people organized themselves and forced their demands onto the agenda. And the high point here would be from the 1920s, after the Russian Revolution and influenced by the Russian Revolution, into the 1960s, LBJ being the last incarnation of this. That was the heyday of progressive liberalism. And the reason it was progressive was that you could say the left civilized them. The left showed them the importance of looking at and attending to the needs of the vast majority. Since the decline of the labor movement in the 1980s, what you've seen is a kind of a degeneration of dominant discourse and liberal culture as well. We are in the midst of that now. What we're seeing now is essentially what we call identity politics is a political battle within the top 20% of the population for a seat at the table and for a slice of the pie that hasn't grown very much in the last 20 years, because we've been in an era of very slow growth. In slow growth capitalism, you start fighting over who's gonna get a slice of a pie that's not expanding very much. And in that, you see these culture wars being an instrument for that, towards that end, because the professional classes, the politicians, et cetera, use their identities as a currency to try to embarrass or shame or to mobilize some constituency for whatever ends that they can manage. It's, in my view, it's connected to the decline of the social forces that forced dominant and liberal culture to be serious about being wide-ranging and serving the needs of the vast majority.
I mean, I think it's clear. We see how it all plays out and how it also, in my opinion, very intentionally divides people who could very easily find solidarity in just taking a good hard look at their working conditions, at their wages, at how things play out in their workplaces. But a lot of workers have been distracted from that, and the focus has been on, you know, the identity differences among them, which makes it incredibly difficult to organize. You know, can you explain the difference between class consciousness and how it differs from false consciousness?
Well, the class consciousness, very simply put, is a situation where workers understand two things. Their common interests across the class with each other, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of race, and regardless of gender. And on the other hand, the interest being opposed to those of their employers. to the people who they're working for and who are making a profit off their labor. So class consciousness has both of these elements in it. Now, among radicals and leftists, for the longest time, there's been this expectation that, hey, if we can see that workers are being treated badly and that they benefit from coming together, then they should too. And we don't see them coming together. So the question becomes, why don't they? Why aren't they banding together to fight better? And the answer from intellectuals has been, well, obviously they're not as smart as us. They don't understand their interests the way we understand their interests. And so their consciousness is a false consciousness. By false, it means they're systematically mistaken in their appreciation, in their understanding of their own surroundings, in their understandings of their own interests. That's supposed to be false consciousness. Now, this reflects a kind of an arrogance on the part of intellectuals. And that's what I try to explain in my book. Intellectuals are very easy to slide to the position that the problem is with the workers and their culture and their ideology, et cetera, and their failure to understand what the intellectuals understand. The reality is, the reason, as you said, workers get sucked into identity politics, workers get sucked into other sorts of things, is because when they're disorganized, when they don't have organizations to back them up, when they don't have trade unions, they have to stick to whatever they find as a means of defending themselves against their employers. And typically what they find available to them is their ties of ethnicity, ties of kinship, their family structures, because people still tend to live in ethnically homogenous neighborhoods, in racially homogenous neighborhoods. They tend to marry within their own race, they tend to marry within their own ethnicities. Those ties substitute for an enabling organization, an enabling set of institutions that a state could provide them. And so the identities attached to them, being an Italian, being a Catholic, being a male instead of a female, is something that they can get some material sustenance out of. Because when you need to find a job, who do you go to? Your cousin. When you need to, when it's a time of dearth and you're unemployed, you don't have means of making ends meet, who do you go to? Your family, your parents, all of that is ethnically and racially homogenous. So identity politics becomes a way of sustaining yourself because there's nothing else that you can rely on. The way out of it is through that collective organization. The problem with that is, how do you organize when you're working at Amazon, when you're working at Walmart, and the entire entity is geared towards blocking, getting in the way of any worker organization? So what happens? Either you get identity politics or people just tune out. And most of the working class tunes out of politics. It feels that there's no point in it.
I mean, that's certainly reflected in voter turnout. Even when we look at elections where we have significant voter turnout, you look at the group of people who decided not to vote at all, and it's still much larger than those who decided to go to the polls. So that's certainly a continuing problem. But you know, there is a little bit of good news. So I want to get to that, because all of a sudden you are seeing some labor militancy. You know, we recently talked about the Kroger workers in Denver who decided to strike, and they just ended that strike because they got a contract they liked. Some of the employees are now getting up to $5 additional per hour. So it shows that organizing your workplace, having a union representation with a strike fund to kind of keep you whole during a strike is really, really important. I think that's inspiring other workers in various workplaces. But you did touch on the fact that, you know, there's a big problem at play when it comes to these major corporations like Amazon, for instance. We saw the failure of the Bessemer, Alabama unionization effort, that Amazon warehouse. And so talk a little bit about the obstacles in place and what needs to be done to overcome them.
You know, it's interesting. You're absolutely right that there is an uptick in strike activity. But it's an interesting point. They're almost all these strikes are undertaken by workers who are already organized, who are already in unions. They're not spontaneous job actions by unorganized workers. And that tells you something. First of all, that workers, hey, look, labor markets tighten up and they have these support checks coming from the stimulus bill. And now suddenly they're less terrified. And when they're less terrified, you see them abandoning identity politics, abandoning the kind of quiescence of the last 30 years, and they suddenly seem to be raising their voice, exactly as a kind of a, you know, an economic and a materialist approach to politics would predict. That's point number one. Point number two is, it's only happening when they're already in unions. And why is that? It's because if you don't have that support behind you that a union gives, that assurance that when you walk out of the job, you will have a strike fund, you'll have some support, you'll have a media presence, there'll be a propaganda campaign. If you don't have that, it's you and your fellow workers against what? Starbucks, Amazon, Walmart. Walmart and Amazon have revenues the size of small countries. Mm-hmm. They own politicians. They own the judges. They own the media. You're up against everything. And so it's the when the power balance is that bad, and on top of that, there's the fact that labor law in the United States is, it might as well not exist. Mm-hmm. It is so geared towards employer interest. It's so hard for employees to strike. You know, it's legal in the United States to bring in replacement workers if your workers go out on strike.
Yep.
It's a miracle that you have any strikes at all when it's legal to do that. In most of the world, an express part of labor law is if a union goes out on strike, you have to negotiate with them as an employer. You can't bring in replacement workers. The Taft-Hartley law allows you to do that. So the whole system is set up to reinforce the power of the employers, not to put a check on that power. That's why workers don't strike. It's not because they're stupid. It's not because they have false consciousness. It's not because they don't understand their situation. It's because they understand it all too well. And that's why the work of getting them organized takes extraordinary amounts of resources, skill, and commitment, which thankfully has worked in the past, and maybe it will do so again.
Yes, and you know, you brought up Starbucks. The Starbucks workers in Buffalo, New York took a tremendous risk and attempted to unionize, and they succeeded. So it's still possible, it can be done, but I think it's really important to understand all of these various forces at play. I think you're right about that. And as depressing as a lot of the news is, I do find a little inspiration in the very least, in the change that I'm noticing in the way people are thinking about politics and the way people are understanding things from a more materialist lens rather than just allowing, for lack of a better phrase, the professional managerial class to make the decisions for them and tell them what's really wrong. You know, people are starting to realize, no, there's a system at play that needs to be challenged here. Vivek, it was a pleasure having you. I could talk to you all day about this issue, and I'm grateful that you were generous with your time today. Please come back. Would love to continue this conversation.
It would be my pleasure, Anna. Thanks, as always, for having me.
Thank you. All right, everyone, we're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we've got a lot more news to get to, including House Democrats rushing to fund another defense bill dedicated specifically to Ukraine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to TYT. Let's get to our next story. After failing to pass a social spending bill that improves all of our lives, congressional Democrats are in a rush to ensure the passage of an additional $500 million defense bill, not for the United States, which would already be bad enough, but for Ukraine. By the way, this is not the first time Congress has appropriated funding for Ukraine and its defense capabilities. This is an emergency attempt to give additional resources. Now look, this is all in the context of Congress and the White House beating the war drums with Russia, which I have cautioned against, not because I like Putin, not because I support Russia, but because I think there needs to be a better approach rather than escalating toward potential war with another nuclear power. I know that gets some people up in a tizzy. I'm sorry that I would like to avoid a possible war with Russia, but that's how I feel. And I also don't trust the White House. I don't trust our intelligence community when it comes to anything they have to say that bolsters their argument toward war. Now, let me continue on though with what these congressional efforts entail. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told members on a caucus call on Tuesday that she's looking to skip marking up the bill and move it straight to the House floor, setting up the possibility of a vote as soon as early next week. Because whenever it comes to war spending, whenever it comes to military spending, do we really need to debate it, ladies and gentlemen? And to be sure, there's always bipartisan support for the war machine, always. Especially when you're dealing with a government that is completely captured by corporate interests. Now, one senior Democratic aide who spoke on condition of anonymity told The Intercept this. This is how the space for non-military options gets slowly closed off in Washington without any real debate. Homeboy or homegirl is an insider. They know what they're talking about, and that statement certainly rings true. Now, what about the Senate? What's the Senate up to? Remember, it's really hard to pass legislation in the Senate with that legislative filibuster that requires 60 senators to vote in favor of anything in order for it to pass, right? No, the Senate is fast tracking this stuff as well. Last week, House Foreign Affairs Committee Chair Gregory Meeks, a Democrat, introduced the legislation, which has 13 co-sponsors, as a companion measure to the Senate's Defending Ukraine Sovereignty Act proposed earlier this month. The Senate bill, introduced by Foreign Relations Committee Chair Bob Menendez, boasts 41 Democratic co-sponsors, including Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Whip Dick Durbin, and progressives Chris Murphy and Jeff Merkley. Chris Murphy and Jeff Merkley. Now, how much money are we talking about? I know I already gave you that spoiler at the top of this segment. The legislation would spend $500 million from the Foreign Military Financing Program to Ukraine for 2022. But that's not the only money that's been appropriated, or it will likely be appropriated for Ukraine. That amount would have made Ukraine the third largest recipient of funding from the State Department's federal military funding account in 2020, surpassed only by $3.3 billion to Israel and $1.3 billion to Egypt. That year, the FMF program gave Ukraine $248 million. Now, remember, when Donald Trump was being impeached the first time, what was he being impeached about again? He had withheld $400 million in military funding that had been appropriated by Congress for Ukraine, for their defense capabilities. I bring that up because that is relevant context to this story. When you're talking about Russia and its actions on its own borders, when you hear about the troops that they're amassing at their border and you're seeing that as an offensive move, I just want you guys to consider the fact that the United States has been providing weaponry and military funding to Ukraine for years. They've been expanding NATO eastward for decades, even after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Remember, NATO was meant to be an international alliance to prevent the influence, to contain the Soviet Union. That was the whole point. So when people are like, why? Well, what's wrong with NATO? Like, why does Russia see NATO as a threat? Because NATO was formed specifically in response to the Soviet Union and was never disbanded after the Soviet Union collapsed. So it's always been it's always been sold as a deterrent for Russia. Right? And so Russia sees it as a threat in that now, when it comes to Ukraine joining NATO, well, they're talking about a border country that, you know, is now being funded, weaponized, and all of that by the United States and its NATO allies. And why would anyone, why would any country be concerned about the motivations of the United States? It's not like the United States has ever done, I don't know, preemptive wars before. It's not like the United States has ever lied to the American people about its intentions in various, you know, conflicts that it's decided to engage in. It's not like the vast majority of Americans are completely in the dark about military efforts that we're currently engaged in African countries, like Niger, where members of our military were killed, you know, few years ago, and everyone's like, why are we in Niger? What's going on? Look, this is not to support Russia, but it's just insane to me how quickly money gets approved. Our precious resources get approved or appropriated toward any type of military effort. Which, look, if this is just meant to bolster Ukraine, ensure that they can protect themselves from a possible invasion, that would be fine, I guess. My issue is, we just had months and months of debate over a social spending bill that would have improved our lives, and that got blocked. We ain't getting that bill. That bill is dead. But anytime there's any type of conflict, we love to stick our noses in it and we love to immediately approve, fast track the funding for it immediately. How do you not get angry at that? And then they'll use the same talking points that they've used in every other conflict. We have to do it. Oh my God, this is a major threat. We have to do it. They'll never take responsibility, the US government, for everything that they engage in to escalate the conflict. They'll pretend like we're totally innocent and we're so peaceful and we're so calm and we're just trying to live our lives, you know? And the Russia, the bad boy Putin, it's all Putin's fault. No, but what about our behavior? What about our track record of orchestrating coups in Latin American countries? What about our role in completely destabilizing Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq? For all the so-called lefties online right now who are also engaging in beating the war drums and feel so disappointed that I'm calling for a de-escalation, ask yourself, why are you so gullible to believe the same government that has lied to you about foreign relations for decades? Wake up. You're supposed to be better. And you want to get mad at me, get mad at me. I don't care. But this is more of the same garbage. And it's pathetic that anyone would fall for it. All right, we gotta take a break. I'm gonna calm down. And when we come back, John Iadarola will be joining me for more news.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Young Turks. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, Cenk Uygur, and I'll see you soon.